everybody. What is going on? Welcome, welcome, welcome once again to a brand new episode of Sweeten Up Podcast, season number 2, episode number 77. I hope everyone is doing well. I am your host, Jeff Spencer. Thank you so much for taking some time to join me today. I greatly appreciate it, whether you have for an entire season or you are today for the first time. Thank you so much for joining us. However, if you are just joining us for the first time, take a look back at our library of 76 episodes anytime you want, anywhere you subscribe to the show. As always, if you like what you hear on the podcast today, please be sure to tell all your friends and subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts so that you never miss a future episode. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Sweeten Up Podcast. Be sure to head on over and give us a follow or like. With that being said, my guest on the podcast today is the great and powerful Jim Himes. Jim Himes is an American businessman and politician, currently serving as the United States Representative for Connecticut's 4th Congressional District since 2009. Himes' district includes most of the southwestern corner of the state and is largely coextensive with the Connecticut side of the New York metropolitan area. It includes parts of Fairfield County and New Haven County, including the cities of Bridgeport, Norwalk, Fairfield, and Stamford. It was an honor to have the opportunity to speak to Congressman Himes, and we chatted for close to an hour, filled with plenty of laughs, talking about recent legislation in D.C. and what it means for the state of Connecticut, learning how Congressman Himes got his start in politics, what he enjoys doing in his free time, and so much more. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, my friend and one of my favorite people and politicians, Congressman Jim Himes. Joining me on the podcast today via Zoom video conferencing, it is quite a special honor to have this incredible human being on the other side of my computer screen. He is an American businessman, a politician serving as the United States Representative for Connecticut's 4th Congressional District since 2009, the great and powerful Congressman Jim Himes. And Congressman Himes, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I'm so appreciative. It's so good to see you. You're looking great. And how are you today, my friend?
Doing great, doing great. What a way to start the day! I'll tell you, I've got two daughters who will quibble with your sense of great and powerful, but we'll set that aside for the moment. Hope they didn't hear that upstairs.
Sounds good. Well, listen, thank you so much. This, you know, like I said, this is quite an honor. It's such a pleasure to get to talk to you, and I know you're so busy. There's so much going on in D.C. right now. So thank you. And one place I really like to start with my guests, and I have been for a little while now, is, you know, I like to get my guests' perspective on how they got through such a difficult time last year, because everyone's got a different angle, everyone's got a different perspective and a different view on how they were able to cope with such a terrible and difficult situation with the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown and just everything that took place. So how did you get by in such a difficult time, and what was the pandemic like for you and your family and everyone like that?
Yeah, great question, and hopefully it's a rear view mirror question, right? I mean, I know we're not quite sure about the Omicron variant, but hopefully it's a rear view mirror question, and it's a great question, I'll tell you, and I suspect everybody probably has a slightly different answer, I'll tell you first and foremost, you know, I'm in public service, right? So I really, you know, when things are going really well, you know, economy's cranking along and there's no pandemic and stuff, you know, you aren't necessarily as mission focused as you become or as I became during COVID, right? So, I mean, 2 months after the identification of COVID, the Congress passed the CARES Act, which delivered a huge amount of relief, you know, to individuals in the form of checks and to businesses in the form of the Paycheck Protection Program loan. And I and my staff really went to work to make sure that everybody out there understood the kinds of benefits that were available to them, because it was kind of, you know, almost life and death for some people, right? Because the economy shut down. And so, number one, I would say just, you know, going to work in a moment of crisis, that doesn't necessarily sustain a person. So we were very lucky. And, sometimes it almost makes me feel guilty to say this, because the pandemic was such a tragedy for so many people. You know, we're at 800,000 American fatalities, but, you know, both my daughters were home, and I'm a guy who always kind of worked hard, and, you know, I probably never strung three dinners in a row together with my daughters, but I was, you know, night after night after night, the family was getting together for dinner. And like I said, it makes me feel almost guilty to say it, because it was such a tragedy for so many people, but for my family, you know, that opportunity to be together and to really get to know each other was hugely sustaining.
Gotcha. Excellent. Yeah. And I know so many people had, some people had a tough time. Some people, there were certain moments they got to enjoy that they didn't get to enjoy. And so everyone had a different take and perspective on it. So I really appreciate you for sharing that. And getting right into it, sort of take me back to your early days, your childhood, where you grew up, everything like that. And did you always think at a young age that you would be a congressman, or were you kind of looking at, you know, setting your sights on other things and it just, the opportunity just kind of rose? But definitely take me back.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an interesting question with a kind of a complicated answer. You know, like every sort of 7, 8, 9, 10 year old, I was going to be an astronaut or a fireman or something. So no, I can't tell you all the way back. But the honest answer to your question is, you know, first of all, I spent the first 10 years of my life or so in South America because my dad was working down there. And that had an effect on me. You know, it interested me in foreign policy, and I do a lot of national security stuff now. And, you know, it really gave me an appreciation for the country. I was born in Peru and lived there and lived in Colombia for a while. And those are perfectly nice countries. But, you know, to move to the United States when I was 10 years old, more or less, you know, and to just see the freedom and the, and by freedom, I don't just mean political freedom. I mean, you know, as a 10-year-old, I could run down the street and get on my bicycle and ride around the block, you know, which is not something you could typically do in a place like Colombia without fear of something. Was huge. And, you know, to give you a really short answer to your really big question, I guess I've always had an appreciation for what government can do when it gets stuff right. And I'm thinking the civil rights movement, you know, which transformed this country in the 1960s. You know, I was a toddler when the United States put a man on the moon. A lot of times I'll wave around my iPhone in a high school and just say, hey, you know, if you want to think about how government can work with business and others to really accomplish amazing things, think about what's in this iPhone, right? On the one hand, it's a private company that makes them. On the other hand, a lot of the basic research that went into the stuff that's in an iPhone, whether it's GPS or voice recognition or semiconductors, came out of government research labs. And so that's a long way of saying that I've always been really interested in what government could do when it operates well and competently. I thought, you know, someday I want to be part of that. You know, I didn't jump straight into it. I started out in business, spent 12 years in business, and that was deliberate, right? I didn't want to go right. I thought, look, if I'm going to be in the government, I'm going to be thinking about the way the world works and regulating it or passing laws. I ought to actually be out there in the world and see how it works. So I went to business and then eventually found my way into elected politics, which has been enormously satisfying.
That's awesome. And I know that you were a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, and you were also the captain of the lightweight crew team in Harvard. Definitely talk about your days in college. I mean, those are two really awesome schools. And, you know, obviously being a captain and a team leader, you sort of had a knack for leadership, it seems like, early on.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I guess what the story you're telling or my resume shows that I was one of those kids that worked really hard, you know, probably whipped on by a mother in particular who was not accepting B pluses. No way. That was, you know, what happened when you got the B plus, right? And so, yeah, no, I was fortunate to get into some pretty good schools. Yeah, I mean, you ask about leadership. It's an interesting opportunity to talk about leadership. You know, I guess I would say that I didn't necessarily think of myself as a leader. I've got one thing though that I think is underappreciated and that points to leadership, which is I love listening to people, right? And it's ironic because a lot of leaders actually don't listen very well, and I find that particularly in politics, just sort of taking 6 beats to hear somebody through and engaging with what they have to say and taking it on board is just a huge, in some ways, gift to them. You know, it doesn't happen a lot these days, especially these days. But I guess I've always kind of been a listener, and I'm not going to tell you I'm some, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, 4-star general leadership type. But I do love listening to people, and I think that probably was appreciated over a long period of time.
Nice, excellent. And you know, in 2009, when you became congressman for the 4th District here in Connecticut, you know, what was that like? What was that day like? You know, just knowing that you were coming to DC and you were going to represent Connecticut and, you know, Fairfield County and in the other areas of the state.
Oh my Lord. Yeah, that was really something. that was a really crazy day. I'm not sure I ever really believed that I was going to win the election of 2008. You know, when Barack Obama got the nomination to be the presidential candidate, I thought, wait a minute, maybe, maybe, maybe. And the reason I thought that was because, you know, I could sense very early on that Barack Obama would galvanize African American voters as he did, and galvanize young voters in a way that maybe we'd never seen before. And sure enough, that happened. And so, you know, no illusions here. I got elected in 08. Yeah, I worked hard, but I got elected in 08 on Barack Obama's coattails. But I don't think there was a moment until election night where I thought, oh, I'm definitely going to win this thing. And so, you know, I was up against, by the way, a very decent guy, Chris Shays. Many people in the area remember him. Old school Republican. And by old school, I mean, they don't make him like him anymore. You know, very, quite liberal, actually, in a lot of ways, very decent. You know, he doesn't recognize his own, at least the extremes of his own party anymore. I saw him actually just a couple weeks ago, very decent guy. And, you know, he'd done really well because he was a decent guy. And so, yeah, when those returns came in and he actually ultimately called me and said, congratulations, I almost fell over. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, it's that great line at the end of the movie where, you know, the presidential candidate wins and you know, I think it's Robert Redford, right? Says, oh my God, what do we do now? And I realized, you know, I'd never been a legislator, right? So I was like, okay, I got to check out about 10 books from the library and educate myself really, really quickly.
Nice. Yeah. That I imagine that, getting to DC, that those first couple of weeks must've been pretty interesting.
Well, you know what was amazing about it? There was a 2 month period, maybe 3 month period tops, where the country had just elected an African American president, and even folks out there on the right, you know, they knew they weren't going to like Barack Obama's policies, but even there was just for about 2 months this feeling of celebration on both sides of the aisle. And again, you know, the Republicans didn't much like Barack Obama, but just the fact that this country would finally elect a black president. There was just this feeling of pride in the country. Now, you know, that went south pretty quickly, but I do remember those initial months as a very special period, especially given where we are today.
Yeah, no, so true. And, you know, Barack Obama was actually the first president I was legally old enough to vote for. So he was the first president I ever voted for. Of course, his second term, not the first one. Wish I could have voted the first one. And I love that photo of you and Barack behind you. That's awesome. That's a great shot. And so that must have been great working for him. But let's get down into it. Everything that's been going on in D.C., now we got Joe Biden, and, you know, he's doing the best he can with the mess that he was essentially walked into. But I know that recently some good things have happened, and one of those was the passing of the infrastructure bill. And I definitely wanted to ask you your thoughts on the passing of the bill, all the work that led up to it, and what it is going to mean for Connecticut.
Sure. Well, that's a great story. You know, it's a great story in substance. I'm not sure the political effects are going to be felt for a while. And that's a big deal as we think about the midterm elections. But let's just talk about the substance of that. You know, I've been doing this for a while now, over a decade. And for all of that time, I've been saying, you know, the country has to pass a major investment in our infrastructure. And if you live where we do, you feel that every single day, you know, whether you're on 84 bumper to bumper, 95, the Merit, on Metro North trains that move more slowly than trains move 75 years ago. I mean, we're not unique in this regard, but we really experience the erosion of our quality of life and the economic pain of lousy infrastructure. So I could not be more proud that we finally said, after many, many years, after many generations, that we're gonna take the long view and really invest, and not just invest, right, but invest in a forward-looking way. Because, you know, as you know, the infrastructure bill, in addition to the traditional bridges and highways and all that stuff, you know, has money for things like electric vehicle charging networks. It has things to make sure that, for example, every kid, and as you and I both know, even in an affluent community like Connecticut, there are a lot of people without access to broadband. So we'll be investing in making sure that every family has access to broadband. And, you know, the cherry on the top of that ice cream sundae, too, is the fact that it was strongly bipartisan. It doesn't happen a lot, right? We're in a very fraught, very dangerous moment in our politics. But the fact that Republicans and Democrats said, let's get this done, and linked arms and got it done, is a really healthy thing for our politics, quite apart from the benefit that we're going to get with respect to our infrastructure.
Yeah. And I mean, and like you said, the 84, there's a bridge in Southbury, the Rochambeau Bridge. They've been working on that for a long time. And there's just so many bridges and roads that really need some help, and just overall in general. And I was so glad to see that the bill passed, because, yeah, like you said, it's going to be huge. I mean, I don't know how many times when I used to commute to my old job in Westchester County, New York, just how many times I had to change my tire in a year, probably about 10 times because of all the potholes and just the roads were just terrible. So I was thrilled to hear that this had passed for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I'd come back to, as long as you're talking about commuting, I'd come back to the broadband. You know, maybe you and I, maybe we've got really good, given what we do, really good broadband. But, you know, one of the silver linings in the pandemic is that we all learned that you didn't actually need to go drive into the office every single day, Monday through Friday, 4 weeks a month. You know, maybe you're actually better at doing your job if you spend 3 days a week or 2 days a week or 1 day a week at home telecommuting. That, of course, relies on good, consistent broadband access. And so again, I'm really excited that it's not just bridges and roadways, that it's also, you know, making sure that what we're going to be doing in the 21st century is enabled.
Completely agreed. Completely agreed. And especially since we got different variants coming out and who knows if we're going to have to stay home for another period of time. Hopefully not. Hopefully it's in the rearview mirror, but I guess we'll see soon. So yeah, I totally agree. The addition of broadband is excellent. Another bill that's going on right now, the Build Back Better. I understand it passed the House, not yet the Senate. How big is that? And what would that also mean for Connecticut?
Yeah, good question. And this one, I think, is less of a full-blown celebration. And the reason I say that is because it's not going to be bipartisan, and that makes me sad. But maybe it's maybe it's too much to hope for in these polarized times. And I'll tell you, it's also, unlike the infrastructure bill, which I think was really well crafted, there's some really, really good things in the Build Back Better plan. You know, I'll highlight the one I think is best, which is, well, two that I think are best. Number one, it has universal pre-K. So that means that, you know, children between the ages of 3 and 5, regardless of where they are and where you and I sit, we're talking about cities like Danbury and Bridgeport and Norwalk, where there are kids living in poverty, right? Those kids now are going to have an option to go to high quality, affordable childcare. And you just can't say enough about the value of that, right? Because number one, a child who, you know, is put in front of a television set between the ages of 3 and 5, arrives at school not ready to learn, with a much lower vocabulary than the kid who's actually had access to good childcare. And oftentimes the need to look after that child prevents mom or dad from actually going to work. So this universal childcare thing, I just can't say enough about it, because kids are going to be better prepared for school. That means they're going to be more successful in life. And parents are going to have the option, which in some cases I didn't have before, to go to work. So to me, that's actually kind of the crown jewel of the plan. I said two things, though, because I didn't want to leave behind the very, very significant commitment to addressing climate change. Biggest one we've ever done. And we can get into that if you like. But, you know, this really represents a huge move towards sustainability. So I'm pretty excited about it. And as you can probably tell from the way I started to answer the question, there's certainly things I would change about it. And the good news is it's not done yet. It's still getting taken up at the Senate, but I'm pretty unhappy with some of the aspects of the taxation in it. Not because it breaks President Biden's pledge not to raise taxes on households making under $400,000. But, you know, I think as written, as it passed the House, it misses an opportunity to do what we want to do, which is to make sure that the very wealthiest Americans pay their share. And you know, the wealthiest Americans are wealthy because they have huge assets, right? In many instances, they don't have massive incomes, but they have massive assets. Think of Jeff Bezos, right? Richest man on the planet, I guess. You know, his income is actually, you know, not crazy. I mean, there's probably, you know, very successful plastic surgeons who have bigger incomes than he does, but we've really missed an opportunity there to tax wealth, you know, through things like a capital gains tax, through things like estate tax. So anyway, I won't go on about that, but my hope is that as it winds its way through the Senate, it gets smarter and more pointed, and we pass a really good bill.
Gotcha. And I'm also very glad you brought up climate change, because that's something that's very important to me, and especially you know, the generation that is around me and the generation before me. I know it's huge, because what's going to be left if we keep going the course we're on right now? So definitely, what are your thoughts on climate change, and what are some things that we can do, and what are some things we're trying to do?
Well, you know, on a challenge as serious as climate change, we've got to be very, very honest with ourselves. And While I'm a big fan of what the bill does, because it's the biggest commitment the federal government, that the people of the United States through the federal government have ever made towards addressing climate change, it still falls short. And it falls short because, you know, we're going to be struggling with issues of climate change and sustainability until we do the one thing, which, by the way, is a market-oriented thing that would really very rapidly move this country to a more sustainable place. And what I mean by that is until we correctly price carbon. Now, it's too early in the morning for us to get into a discussion of economic externalities, but you know, there is a very common concept known as externalities. It's pollution, essentially. When the cost of using something is not reflected in the price, which is what happens when we burn carbon, because the cost, of course, is the destruction of our planet, you have a problem. And so if we were really, really serious about this, we would do something that I've been supportive of for a long time, which is a fully refundable carbon fee. And what that would say is it would say that when you put a gallon of gas in your tank, you'd pay, pick a number, the scientists would calculate it, but you'd pay, you know, 20 cents on top of the cost, that would be the fee. But, and here's the kicker, this is the key part, you'd get it back on a per capita basis. So it's fully refundable. Now, why is that important? It's important because that correctly prices carbon, which means that the market is now going to make, you know, all the sustainable forms of energy much more competitive. But my friends on the right say, okay, well, if you're going to charge a fee, you can't use that to grow the size of government. You got to give it back. So that's the point. We would give it back on a per capita basis. And if you think about that, and I know it's a little complicated, but if you think about that, it's a very progressive way of doing things because, you know, lower income people have much smaller carbon footprints than wealthy people. Not a lot of low income people flying around on private jets, right, which use a lot of carbon. So it's a very progressive way of correctly pricing carbon in a way that would unleash the private sector to really address this problem. So I'm a little disappointed that we're not making more progress on that. But look, I should celebrate the fact that we're making a massive commitment to things like basic research in sustainables and batteries. We're making a massive commitment to financing sustainable energy sources and that kind of thing.
Got it. Now, that's great. I actually haven't heard it put that way before, and it's very interesting, and I like that. I do like that. Another issue right now that's on the forefront is the supply chain issues that we're facing right now. You know, a lot of people really concerned about how long it's going to go on. What are your initial thoughts of the current situation?
Yeah, this is an area in which I'm far from expert. I can't, you know, I've been trying to bone up on, you know, how containers get moved from Antwerp to, or Elizabeth, the Port of Elizabeth. You know, what I can tell you is what lay people like you and me can totally understand, which is that, you know, supply chains from the moment a product gets assembled in a factory in Shenzhen or a factory in Illinois, to when it gets loaded into a container, to when it gets delivered to your house, every step of the way there involves people. Fewer people than it did 100 years ago, obviously, because we've got technology today, but it involves people, and people are scared, right? And people's lives have been upended, their work lives have been upended. And as a consequence, every step of the way of these supply chains, we've got bottlenecks that are chiefly driven by something very legitimate, which is people's fear of this pandemic. So the one thing I know for sure, and we're, I think, all keeping our fingers crossed, is that, you know, hopefully this Omicron variant proves not to be too scary. Hopefully we finally finish the process of, you know, vaccinating everybody. I know that that last sort of 20% is really hard to get to, but, you know, as long as people are living with a lot of fear of dying in a hospital, they're going to be very careful about, you know, going to work or what have you. So, though I'm no expert on supply chain, the more responsible we are with vaccines and with masking and being careful about this, the sooner we'll return to normal.
Exactly. No, totally agreed. And thank you for that. I know you're a big advocate on gun control. Obviously, being in Connecticut, me having lived in Newtown most of my life, basically my entire life, you know, the Sandy Hook school shooting, you know, my dad was a custodian there at the time. And I remember seeing you on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, where he says, you know, I always see you after a shooting, and there always seems to be a shooting to see you after. And you know, and that struck me, and I know how, you know, how big you are in this issue. And with the recent shooting that just took place in Michigan, yet again, another school, more innocent people, you know, more murders, and it's sad. And I I wish there was something we can do. And I know, you know, John Stewart said it great. I thought that once they started murdering kindergartners, that would be the end of it. But here we are. So what are your sort of your thoughts on this situation that's just so difficult to tackle?
Yeah, gosh, it's a huge frustration for me. It's really very painful. Probably not as painful as it is for you. I didn't realize that your father had been in that school. That was obviously something that still haunts those of us from Connecticut, and should haunt everybody. And as you point out, I mean, yeah, it's not just Michigan, right? Once every couple of days, we get a school shooting. And the reason it's so frustrating is that, you know, you say I'm for gun control, and okay, that's fine. I'm not going to disagree with you there, but this is one area that's just not that hard, right? I support the Second Amendment. By the way, I took an oath to protect the Second Amendment, but that doesn't mean that I can't say we should have universal background check. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't put some limitations on the kind of weaponry, including the weaponry that that shooter used at Sandy Hook Elementary School. You know, weaponry that is primarily designed to kill a whole lot of people really quickly and therefore should be largely in the hands of people who need to do that, like our combat forces. You know, it just, to me, this is, mechanically speaking, a really simple issue, meaning, you know, we can protect the right of hunters. We can protect the rights of people who believe they're safer if they have a firearm in their home. By the way, you know, I'm going to respect your belief on that, but my God, look at the statistics. And if you really want to create a dangerous home, buy a firearm and keep it there. But anyway, my point is that, you know, we can protect those rights and at the same time do away, not with all gun violence, we'll never do that, but with a huge swath of it. And we know that because we're the only country on the planet that experiences this day after day carnage. But here's the problem. And again, I get irritated just talking about it. This has become a cultural thing. It's a cultural identifier, right? For a guy like Ted Cruz, to give the extreme example, but even for most Republicans, to say that I'll contemplate universal background check is to say I'm going to betray my tribe, you know, because we're the guys who stand up for the Second Amendment against those Democratic gun grabbers, which is insane when you think about it. But that's where we are. That's where we are. And frankly, the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers have been really good at ginning up this notion that if, you know, it's the old slippery slope argument. If you do something like universal background check, the next thing you know, there are black helicopters on your front lawn confiscating your weaponry. And it's really frustrating for me to have an absurdity like that, to have an utter absurdity resulting in the daily killing of our children and of our people. So I don't, we've worked so hard, we've tried so many things, and yet we keep hitting this brick wall.
No, I totally agree. And the minute you say you're for gun control, you're a gun advocate, you know, it's always, oh, you're the left and you're just trying to take guns and blah, blah, blah. You know, my thing on that is I have a lot of friends who have guns and they're extremely responsible. In fact, you never see them. They're always tucked away. And they're, you know, I they're responsible. And I feel bad sometimes that, you know, there's certain people out there that do bad things with guns and put a bad light on those who are actually good with guns. But yeah, you're right. That's always you're left or you're right. It's always one side or the other. It can never just be common sense.
Well, I wish we could get those responsible gun owners because I know a lot of them too. And frankly, I might even be a gun owner. My wife won't countenance that. But you know, I wish we could get those responsible gun owners to say, hey, you know, we really care about this right that we have, so we should. We should try to protect that right by doing those things that would end the horrible carnage, which they don't support. You read about this Michigan case where this kid's parents have been indicted because of their behavior. And you remember better than I do the Sandy Hook situation where you had a deeply, deeply disturbed kid. You know, these things aren't random, right? You can kind of see them coming in some instances. And that's hard, right? Because not every alienated kid who's walking around in a black raincoat, you know, muttering to himself is gonna become violent. But my point is that these things don't come out of the blue, right? At the community level, we could do a lot more, I think, to identify and support those people who are maybe prone to committing violence. But again, that's a conversation that wouldn't even result in, you know, restricting people's access to firearms. It would result in, you know, more people getting better help sooner when they're feeling alienated.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of that, I did go to school with Adam Lanza. In fact, he was in my grade. We were, you know, same age in my grade. He was in a couple of my classes freshman year of high school. You know, and you could see it. You know, there were differences. He would sit by himself. He would get bullied. There were differences for sure between him and everyone else. And you could see something, but you just didn't know exactly what. And of course, you didn't think it would be as awful as it was.
Yeah, and you have to be super careful about that, because I mean, at one point, we're probably all kind of alienated teenagers, right? So you don't ever want to set up a system that, you know, assumes that people like that are going to be violent or criminal or stuff, but. You know, that also means that we need to do a much better job at taking those kids under somebody's wing and just, you know, making sure that they feel like they've got some outlet that does not involve the murder of their peers.
Exactly. No, I totally agree. And a few more things before we wrap up. And thank you so much, Congressman Himes, for coming on. I really appreciate it. Already learning so much like I thought I would. And one of those things is, of course, January 6th. Where were you? What are your thoughts? Obviously, I've seen a lot of your thoughts, but you know, what were some of your initial thoughts? Where were you at that time? And what can you say about such an awful stain on American history?
Yeah, that's a tough one. A lot of aspects to it. I'll tell you something though. What is sadder to me about January 6th is January 7th, and I'll explain that to you. But, you know, January 6th, you asked where was I? I was in the chamber. And in fact, I was along with Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. We were some of the last people out of the chamber because we were up in the gallery. You know, they were spreading us all out because of COVID. So we were up in the gallery, and it's a lot harder to get out up there than it is on the floor. So, yeah, I saw the whole thing. And, you know, I guess I think this, obviously a terrible moment in American history. I mean, I can only imagine what it was for the rest of the world who looks at the United States as the emblem of democracy, to see these people, these murderous people, scaling the walls and breaking the windows of this symbol of our democracy, in many cases talking about hanging the vice president, killing Nancy Pelosi, et cetera. You know, we lost some stature that day, thanks to Donald Trump. And I'll elaborate on that by saying, you know, I saw a lot of these insurrectionists, and, you know, I'm very happy that they're going to jail. You know, they did something absolutely horrendous of historical importance. But there's a little tiny piece of me that says that some, you know, not all of the thousands of people who were in that Capitol day are evil people. A lot of them were severely, severely misguided by none other than the President of the United States, who told them that their democracy was being stolen. And they believed it, you know, and I don't quite know why they believed it, because, of course, there wasn't and isn't a shred of evidence. But, you know, if you and I got convinced that our democracy was being ended, you know, we'd do some pretty wacky things, too. So to me, I'm very glad they're going to jail. They were a threat to my life and the life of my colleagues. But I do have some sense that the guy who started this, and not just that guy, Donald Trump, but the people around him, like Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani, bear the bulk of the responsibility for what happened. My residual sadness, though, as I said, was about January 7th. You know, the fact that right after January 6th, the Republican Party, instead of saying loudly and clearly, and by the way, a few did very briefly, that this is unacceptable, that it is not what the Republican Party stands for, that we will forever banish Donald Trump, who represented the single biggest threat to our democracy since the Civil War, from our ranks, ultimately did the opposite. And, you know, kowtowed to him. You know, too many of my colleagues are trying to suggest that what happened on January 6th was just not that big a deal. Too many of them are supporting Donald Trump, going down to Mar-a-Lago to get his blessing. That's very, very painful. And frankly, you know, I've spent my entire political career in Washington trying to build bridges across the aisle. I really think it's critical. And I think my Republican colleagues would tell you that that's true. That's really, really hard to do these days when some of your colleagues, you know, just can't be clear about what happened and are so concerned for their own political futures that they're continuing to be willing to risk American democracy. It's really hard. And, you know, that's why I say what I do, which is what's hardest for me is what happened after January 6th. And, you know, that continues. We're not done with that yet.
So yes, the January 6th insurrection was awful. And I remember a couple months ago, we had Brendan Smilowski on the show, the photojournalist that took a few infamous photos, but one of them being the Bernie Sanders with the mittens at the Joe Biden's inauguration. And he was there that day, and his firsthand account of and some of the photos he took and some of the things that he said to us were quite disturbing and just, you know, impactful, and the things he saw, just unbelievable. So yeah, just a crazy, crazy day that, you know, unfortunately will be a stain, on us, but hey, I mean, it is what it is at this point.
Yeah. Let's just hope we're moving in the right direction away from that kind of instinct.
Exactly. So I know that you recently were the top 40 fittest reps in 2020 by Men's Health. What was that like? And what's your secret? Because honestly, I could use to lose a few pounds and stay healthy myself. I mean, I feel like I gained, you know, they say COVID 30. I'm thinking I gained more like COVID 60, but what are your tips there, Congressman Hives?
Well, I didn't know that. So 2020, I've got to look that up. How do you like that? Okay. You know, so there's no magic to that. In college, I was an athlete, and it sort of kept me out of trouble and kept some structure to my day. And I find, you know, particularly in these crazy times, there's kind of two things that take the edge off, you know, at the end of the day. One is a nice little workout, and the other one, of course, is a cocktail. And it turns out that one is more healthy than the other. So so I try really hard to emphasize the first. No, you know, I'm pretty lucky, like a lot of my colleagues. I'll skip out. I'm actually an afternoon guy. A lot of my colleagues work out in the morning, but I just find that by the end of the day, a lot of tension, a lot of busyness, your mind is pretty cluttered. And I'll tell you, as I'm getting older, I'm not doing the, you know, hour and a half bike ride anymore or whatever, the 6 mile run, but even just 20, 25 minutes, getting a little bit of exercise. Oh my goodness. It feels so much better. I sleep better. So yeah, it gets harder. I'm older than you are. It gets harder as you get older, but the benefits are pretty wonderful.
Gotcha. Awesome. One thing I read that was super interesting to me was during the blackout in 2003, you couldn't reach your family. So you walked home from Manhattan all the way to Cos Cob, 31 miles. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. That was pretty wild.
yeah, I'd say.
It was a super hot night, right? So yeah, I was working at a great place called Enterprise Community Partners on Union Square down there on 14th Street. And there was that big, you know, big explosion, I guess it was, at the power plant. It just shut down power all over the place. And my wife and I had we had a toddler and a new baby, I guess it was. And, you know, there was some issue around babysitting, and I wasn't sure if my wife was going to be able to get home. And of course, cell phones weren't working. And anyway, so I couldn't reach her. So this didn't start out as a totally insane thing. I thought, okay, I'm at 14th Street. I'll just walk up to 125th Street, you know, where the Harlem train station is, and I'll get the train there. And lo and behold, you get to 225th Street and there are no trains. And well, okay, I'll just walk up to the next station. And the next thing you know, I'm, you know, in the Bronx and, you know, 10 o'clock at night. No, it was actually a hell of an experience, you know, for a guy who's only ever been through there in a car or in a train. It was a heck of an experience. It was sort of a party atmosphere. Fortunately, there were a lot of bars along the way. I had a long way to walk, so I wasn't partaking, but it was kind of fun to see the, you know, people out there and stuff. And, yeah, so again, I didn't start out with that as the mission, but you know, you reach a certain point, you're like, okay, well, I may as well just finish this thing.
Yeah, because I see Chris Murphy when he walks around the state. It's awesome. Sometimes I run into him, and I saw that story, and I thought, well Jimmy Hives could give him a run for his money.
That's right. Murphy and I have never actually sort of tried to do this competitively, but now you got me thinking. I might have to. Now I got to be a little careful, right? Because Murph's a younger man than I am, so I have to be a little careful.
Yeah, and he's been doing it for a little bit, so he's got the experience. Yeah. Oh man. Few other things. One thing is, I know recently you were biking across Connecticut to highlight some of parts of the infrastructure bill. How was that? And also definitely talk to me about your Spotify top five. I know that's been huge right now, the Spotify Wrapped.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking I have to put my Wrapped up on Twitter. I guess that's what folks are doing. But yeah, let's start with the bike ride. Oh my gosh, that was more fun. You know, and I'll tell you, you're from Newtown. I had never really spent time on the ground in Newtown. And so I got just north of my district, the congressional district, kind of left, I guess it would have been Easton. And I get up into Newtown and up into some towns I'd never been through, then Woodbury. And oh my gosh, it was just so beautiful, you know. And I've driven through those towns, been up in Litchfield and that sort of thing. But until you've seen it on a bike on a back road, you have not appreciated how gorgeous much of Connecticut is. And so that was so much fun. Yeah, it was partly about showing all the amazing things you can stop and do. You know, the theory was, let's get people, it was the Memorial, or it was the Labor Day weekend. Let's get people off the couch and have away from their screens and show them a couple things that they might do. It was also a pretty nice way to keep myself out of the office for a solid day, which I really enjoyed. Yeah, but that was just great. I'll tell you, the whole way it ended up, I went up to the Massachusetts border. I guess all told, it ended up being about 85 miles. And other than maybe 10 of those miles, it was just as safe and, you know, back roads, country roads, farm roads, right around Torrington and Litchfield, it got a little busy on the highways there. But other than that, you can ride all over this state without seeing many cars if you stick to the back roads. And that was just great fun.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. And yeah. I know from a friend of the show, Willie Haskell, Senator Will Haskell, he told me early on, he was one of the first few guests we ever had. And I remember he told me, you know, Jim Hines, he loves bees and honey. He's a beekeeper. And I'm like, no way. He goes, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. So definitely talk to us about your love of bees and honey and being a beekeeper.
Yeah. Yeah. So I took this up probably 4 years ago, again, in a sort of quest to stay sane through hobbies and stuff. And I just love it. I mean, it's, as you might imagine, as anybody can imagine, it's contemplating doing it, handling bees is a really scary thing. But the reality is, it's like everything else in life. You know, you get a little training, you talk to some people who know what they're doing. So long as you do it right, you're going to be fine. And I just love it. This year, my hives produced, gosh, probably close to, let's say 60, 70 pounds of honey. I give it away to folks that, you know, invite me over for dinner and that sort of thing. And, it's one of these things where you can just learn so much. I mean, such an interesting little species, so critical, by the way, to human survival, right? I mean, pollinators are about our food supply. Pollinators go away, we go away, right? So there's that aspect to it. Absolutely fascinating creatures. It's something that has a little bit of a investment right up front in terms of courage and energy. By the way, not in terms of money. You know, you can sort of get a startup beekeeping kit for a couple $100. So it's not like you're making a, you know, absolutely massive investment the way you would if you're buying a nice new bike or something. But yeah, I encourage people to try it. You just got to find somebody who knows what they're doing and, you know, spend that first season, you know, consulting with them, maybe getting mentored and stuff. But it's been hugely satisfying. I know people think I'm crazy, but it is.
That's awesome. And listen, I don't know if you're a baseball fan. I'm assuming you probably are. Is it Red Sox or Yankees? That was my show writer said he's either a Red Sox fan for being up in Boston or he's a Yankee fan from being in New York. And he's a Philly fan and I'm a Mets fan. And I said to him, I said, well, what if he's a Mets fan? You're just going to run off that he's a Mets fan. So where does your allegiance lie?
This interview was going so well until you had to bring that up, didn't you? Got to remember, like if I climbed a very high tree in my town here, I could probably see Yankee Stadium just, you know, 20 miles to our south here. So
gotcha.
Well, this will sort of surprise you a little bit. So, and boy, does it ever get me in trouble with Murphy and with Courtney and with all the rest of the reps. I'm a Yankees fan, have been for a very long time. And I'm an Eagles fan because I went to high school in Central Jersey, kind of in the Philadelphia orbit. And this will totally date me, but you know, this was back in Dallas Green days, you know? And so, yeah, yeah.
I can tell you one thing, the writer on our show, Nick Pasquaretta, huge Philly sports fan. And when he hears that, he's going to be very happy. Already a big supporter of yours, but that, I think that's really going to push it over the edge for him.
No, it's great. It loses me all kinds of credibility in New England, but that's what can I do about it? That's who I am.
Gotcha. Two more things. One of those being, what are your thoughts on legalization of marijuana in Connecticut? I know you voted for decriminalization, but it was an issue that a few people wanted me to bring up and ask you. So sort of what are your thoughts on that for the state? Obviously, you know, we're in that space already, but sort of, you know, with different places opening up and just, you know, dispensaries and things like that, sort of what's your take on the situation?
Yeah. Well, let me answer the question directly. Then I'll talk about decriminalization. Look, I'm for it. I, I think that with marijuana and maybe with some other drugs, it ought to be in a legal environment where, you know, it can be regulated, where health officials can oversee it, where people with a problem, an addiction problem, can be dealt with as a health problem rather than as a criminal problem. You know, the amount of money we've spent over the years locking up people for dealing weed, you know, it's just awful. So look, and I say all that to say that that is not the same thing as saying that people should smoke marijuana or a lot of marijuana. You know, I think of it like alcohol, right? You know, adults consuming it responsibly is a question of their choice. We want to shield our kids from it, et cetera, et cetera. But on balance, given the choice, I would choose to bring it into a legalized, regulated environment and yank it out of the criminal environment, which comes with so much kind of awfulness associated with it. The reason I say it that way, though, is because I actually don't think I've ever had to vote on it. You know, decriminalization, legalization are state issues. And so the state legislature certainly has done a lot there. The one little piece of it that the federal government has, and I'll tell you where I am on it, you know, our marijuana businesses around this country are dealing in cash, right? Because they don't trust the federal government not to come down on them if they use the banking system, which is regulated by the federal government. And so I do support something called the Safe Banking Act, which basically says that, you know, the federal government is not going to go after banks for banking those businesses. And that's really important, of course, because I haven't spent a lot of time in dispensaries, but I'm told that they, you know, they're almost exclusively a cash business. And that's a dangerous thing, right? So that's my little piece of it. I think we should make sure that banks can bank these businesses.
Gotcha. And this will lead me into my next question. What are your thoughts on the restaurant relief fund? Do you think it did everything it could have? Were you, did you see it at all? Were you involved in it at all? Because I had a friend who, he sort of didn't think that some of the money went to where it should have. He opened a business somewhat recently, just after the pandemic got going in 2020, late 2019. And, you know, he really struggled for a little bit and he was just concerned that maybe the funds weren't going to the places where they should have. And I'm just, what's your take on that?
Yeah. So no, I'm a big supporter of both the Paycheck Protection Program, which, you know, sent money to employers to pay their employees and in some cases to restaurants, and to the Restaurant Relief Program. You know, very few of our businesses were hammered as hard as any retail facing business. But obviously, I mean, think about what a restaurant is, right? A restaurant is a gathering of people in a small space, and go back into the kitchen, you've got even more people, you know, often very vulnerable people, folks that don't have good access to healthcare, you know, right on top of each other. So, you know, the restaurant industry got absolutely hammered. And I do think that the Restaurant Revitalization Program saved a lot of restaurants in combination with the PPP. But look, your other point is true, too. You know, the story will be told ultimately. But, you know, we had to get a lot of money out into the economy really quickly. You know, we could have put regulation and strictures and all sorts of, you know, challenges to getting that money. And we would have had less fraud. Absolutely. No question about it. But it would have taken many, many more months to get that money out there. So, you know, there are going to be some awful cases. There actually already are, of people who abused those funds. But to some extent, from a public policy standpoint, you know, no such thing as a free lunch, right? If you're really prioritizing getting them cash out to people quickly, yep, there are going to be some bad actors who take advantage of it. So your friend may not be wrong. In fact, I'm sure he'll be right in some ways. But again, we were dealing with an economy which had shut down totally and with people who weren't getting a paycheck. So the decision was made to move it quickly. And that has some implications for, you know, the ability of bad actors to, you know, to take advantage of it.
Gotcha. Understood. Thank you for that. And listen, thank you overall. This was a great talk. Congressman Jim Himes, you're a legend. We love you here in the state of Connecticut. You're awesome. You hold it down for us. You represent us so well, with class and dignity and respect and just all that good stuff that you'd want in a representative. And one last thing I want to ask you before you leave me, it's a question I ask all my guests, and, you know, being here in the state of Connecticut, we're the kings of pizza. New Haven is the best place to get pizza all the time, every year, all over the country. It's New Haven. And so when you ever get a chance to get up to New Haven, you know, I know you're super busy, but when you ever get a chance to be there, the debate is what's the best place to get pizza in New Haven. So what's your favorite place to get pizza in New Haven? And on another note, what are some great places you get pizza either near your office in DC or where you live? And what are some restaurants you like to go to as well? Because we have a ton of chefs on here and we try to support that industry as much as we can, especially now. So What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you had to go to Yankees, Red Sox, and now, right? Like, could we get any more controversial? So I'm just going to answer the question quickly. Absolutely. New Haven, no question. Don't talk to me about Mystic. Don't talk to me about Philadelphia or New York or New Jersey. It is New Haven. Now, any restaurant in New Haven is better than any restaurant in New Jersey, New York, or whatever for pizza. I happen to be a Sally's guy. Okay. I'm always open to, you know, competitors of Sally's inviting me over to try to change my mind. I'm wide open to that suggestion. But yeah, that's who I am. You know, by the way, down here in Fairfield County, I'm not going to say we can do it as well as New Haven does. No way. But, you know, we've got Colony Pizza in Stamford. It's a very unique kind of pizza. But, you know, if you're in Stamford, you got to pop by Colony. First of all, it's old school. Oh, my gosh. The Colony Grill is so much fun in Stamford.
Cool.
You get yourself a hot oil pizza there and you're a happy, happy person. Restaurants, I'll tell you, you know, so DC, where I spend, you know, a third half of my time, 20 years ago, DC was a lousy food town. You get yourself a well-done burnt steak and some lousy mashed potatoes. And that was kind of it. You'd way overpay. Now, thanks to, you know, chefs like Jose Andre, who's got four or five restaurants down there, DC is actually becoming a foodie town. Any one of the Jose Andre restaurants, by the way, I'm not supposed to make commercial advertisements, but he happens to have four or five really, really good restaurants in DC. It's becoming a foodie town. So if you come down and visit, you pop by my office and we'll slide you a little suggestion for a couple of really good restaurants that you can get a good meal at in DC.
Sounds good. Sounds good. And you know what? I got to come down to DC. So maybe I'll link up with your office and say hi and pop in or something like that. That'd be awesome. It's always a pleasure to get to see you, whether you're here in front of me now or you're on TV or you're doing your thing for Connecticut. And we appreciate you so much. And thank you for your time. I know you're super busy. So thank you so much, Congressman Jim Himes, the 4th District here in Connecticut. Thank you so much, my friend.
And thank you. Thank you. Really enjoyed chatting anytime.
Yeah. And I hope you have a great day. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Huge thanks once again to my guest on the podcast today, the wonderful Congressman Jim Himes. Thank you so much, Jim, for giving me some of your free time. It was so great to chat with you about the issues, how you got your start, and more. And I wish you all the best as you continue to fight for what is right, as well as representing our state with dignity and class. Hope to come down to DC soon for a visit. Yet again, another episode of Sweeten Up is in the books. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. We would greatly appreciate your feedback. As a reminder, you can play the podcast with the help of your smart speaker or smart device by simply saying, play the podcast Sweeten Up with Jeff Spencer. Thank you as always to my best friends, the guys who make it all possible, post-production and music Morgan Lutzi, production and art director Kurt Vinci, editor and writer Nick Passacretta, and a special thanks as always to Devin Cipelli. My guest on the podcast next week is the always wonderful and returning guest, Nevianesh Gaba. Nevianesh Gaba is the owner of Aquila's Nest Vineyard in Newtown, Connecticut, that has now been open for over a year. Neviana was a guest on the podcast last year in season 1, episode number 30, where we discussed how the vineyard came to be, her roots, and so much more. And now, she's returning to the show to chat with us about how her first year went, new additions to the vineyard, how they've grown so much in just a year, and much, much more. We are so excited to have her back on the show, and we hope you will join us. But until then, you know the deal. Stay safe, stay healthy, love you all, peace.